Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Enterprise Business 100 for Spring Semester 2014. Special Lecture 1, delivered on March 4, 2014. The title of this lecture is Business Law.
Today, law. On Thursday, we will cover contract law as well. But at first, I want to bring you up to a little bit of speed. Consider this an introduction light to the giant topic of law. In this lecture, you'll find that there are several facts that you might not have known before, even from a civics course you might have taken in high school. And you will have a full legal environment of business course here later, if you aren't already in it, that will cover some of this information as well. I will try to key it as soon as possible to business law, but there's a lot of ground in law itself that I just have to bring up before we get down to narrowing it down to business. The first thing that I would want to start out with, madam, what is law? Rules that are imposed by the government. Okay. Well, that might be a working definition. The problem is that law can be divided up so many different ways. Oftentimes, in a course like this, I will split law along two axes in various ways. For example, I could write that there is statutory law versus common law. That's the first way that I will break law down. You see, actually, I'll start with the somewhat more modern one. Some societies, governments, if you will, they will want law to be laid out in writing, very specific, so that when there is an issue that comes up under law, those who adjudicate can look at the law. Those who want to know about the law can read a document, a statement. This is the law. When you have law like that, we call it statutory law. It is stated. It is declared. Now, the example that I give that is the best, probably, is the example of Roman law. That would be Lex Romana, the law of the Romans. It was written law. Layer after layer, law after law, as the Roman Empire grew, as new matters came to bear. In a statutory law, in this kind of law, everything has to, that's a legal matter, has to be written down so that a judge, considering a case, will look at the law and apply the law to the facts of the case. And the law is in writing. Statutory law, Lex Romana. Everything written down so that judges could look at the law in writing that was passed by the Roman Senate with the advice and consent of the emperor or the Caesar, as it were. And the judge could say, well, this is the law, and you have done this, you have violated, and so off with your head or whatever. Now, you imagine that this kind of Roman law was tough and harsh. not any more so to in many ways than the law that we have in the United States, in our country. And there was an understanding that this law was to be applied fairly and widely. And if there were a foreigner who was spending time in the Roman territories, there would be an understanding, well, you broke a law, you parked your cart in front of the Colosseum and you weren't supposed to do that. Well, in my country, we do that. Well, I understand that. And we are going to let you off. But when in Rome, do as the Romans do from now on. So it wasn't that that harshness, but it did get worse and worse as time went on. You see, the more laws there are, the more complex the understanding of law has to be. So that as time went on, a commoner would have a much more difficult time facing accusations under the law. A lawyer would have to be more and more specialized. The joke was that, well, you don't want that lawyer because that lawyer specializes in the page of law before yours. I'm sorry. And that made it more and more detached. Special interests got their laws put in. Oh, there ought to be a law for this. Okay, we put in a law for that. There ought to be a law for that. Okay, there's a law for that. It got enormously complicated as the Roman Empire proceeded through time, ludicrously so. But Lex Romana, a statutory law, was imposed throughout the Roman Empire. So where you see, for example, in Europe, written law, statutory law countries, those would probably be countries that were under Roman occupation. France is an example. France is famous for the Napoleonic Code, a written body of law that can draw straight back to the idea that law must be written down because France was in the Roman Empire. But you go to Germany, go to the highlands, to the lowlands, the farther north you go, the less likely you are to see written law. You go to Africa, you will not see written law. Parts of Eurasia and Asia, you will not see written law. You might see right laws in writing, but it is not statutory law. It is the other flavor of law, common law, the law of the tribe, the law of the elders. In this kind of law, decisions are made based upon ancient principles. And then as time proceeds and cases like that come again, the principle of stare decisis applies. Respect the precedent. Look back. Stare at the decision, as it were. Know what the elders decided. Don't look at some written law. You should understand our law. There is, interestingly enough, a fluidity. You cannot just, oh, I'm going to decide it this way as a judge. You have to consider the past. If there's something unusual that has happened and changed circumstances, yes, then you probably would want to at least partially breach the precedents that had been set in the past. But in general, you hold to the tribal decisions before you. It is more difficult in many ways to apply this law, you see, and to conduct a society under this law, but it is also easier. It is more difficult. A great example was explained to me many years ago when I was doing undergraduate work in anthropology. A professor from Africa, Ojo Arewa, He explained to me, well, in my country, you could not decide a simple case. You couldn't even dream of being a judge deciding very simple cases until you're in your 50s, maybe 60s, because it takes that long to know the past well enough. All of the decisions throughout the thousands of years of our society's history. In statutory law, oh, I just look at a book. Oh, there it is. Yeah, simple. But in common law, you have to really know a lot about your past. And in that way, the society binds much more strongly to its past. Unlike now, oh, the past doesn't matter. Who the hell cares? We're free. We're the 21st century. We've got smartphones. We got Google Glass. We don't need anything from the past. Well, in common law countries, yes, you do. And you begin to understand that pretty much anything that is happening now has a precedent in the past. That doesn't mean that the past was always right, but it means that the past is there as the guiding light for the now. You have a tether to the past. Here's the problem in the United States and in Great Britain. You see, in the 4th and 5th centuries of the Christian era, the British Isles were, quote-unquote, invaded by these Low German tribes, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. And they it was more like a migration slash invasion over a period of many, many years. You've probably seen some movies where the Saxons with their tin helmets come roaring in, kill and rape and pillage and all that. Well, it wasn't always like that, but the peoples who had been there before pretty much were driven down and eventually wiped out. Druids, Picts, and all that. And when the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes came in, they brought their law with them. Tribal law. Common law. The Romans were never all that great at taking over Germany. They kept running into it and finding a bunch of crazy-ass mofos up there. And as a result, common law held in Germania. And the Low German tribes that came across the channel and took over the British Isles, they brought common law with them. So England as a concept really wasn't. It was just sort of a patchwork of warlords' territories for a long, long time. But England as a concept that would be modern in our consideration was a common law country. The common law that was brought by the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. The primary tribes that took over the main strip were the Angles and the Saxons. Hence, we use the term Anglo-Saxon. The Jutes were in some of the islands off the coast, but mostly. But so England in the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th centuries, you're looking at a country that was common law. And as power consolidated in a couple of warlords, it became a more unified kind of common law. There was certainly not a unified England, king of everything. But there were some very significant players in the game. And so there was a spreading commonality of common law. And then the English, and they were English by this time, in a series of fights that they were having with the French, got their asses kicked by a northern French group called the Normans. The Normans were French, but they had German in them. They were more in, ultimately, the French occupation sort of withered away because the Normans just became English. But that was over a period of some two or three centuries that happened. But important here is that the Normans brought with them statutory law. They were from a French place, so they had this idea that everything had to be written law. Romans did it that way, we do it that way. And so this occupied nation, England, that we have now taken in the Battle of Hastings in AD 1066, is going to be French in every way possible. It was pretty rough. They imposed the French law system, statutory law. They imposed French ways. They didn't like a lot about the English. Apparently, they were offended by Anglo-Saxon mannerisms. So, a good example, before the Norman invasion, you would eat cow. Well, you don't eat cow. That's awful. That's so un-French. You have to call it buff. Buff? Yes, buff. You don't eat cow, you eat buff. But isn't buff cow? Well, yes, but we don't call it cow. You don't eat pig, you eat pork. Isn't it a pig? Yes, but you don't call it what you eat it, for God's sake. You don't call it, I'm eating a chicken. No, pouillet. We overcame that one. But you see, it was a comprehensive attempt to transform English society into a French society. And as I said, in the end, it kind of ended up just being kind of a sort of a mishmash, attempting to impose French on the French language. All that did was make English become a much simpler language. English was really complicated, Old English was. But by the time you got into the French occupation, all it did was make English get simpler, the way we talk now, but it held. And eventually we adopted a bunch of French words, but we certainly didn't give up and take French. In law, what happened was that ultimately we got this weird kind of blend coming out of the main period of the French occupation, the Norman occupation. We still had common law, but overlying it was a statutory law. So you would have, ultimately, what came about was that there would be written laws, but then judges would determine how to interpret that statutory law for a given case, looking back to the past of how it had been interpreted before. In other words, the tribal law was still holding, but it was holding within the framework of a statutory law. That's the best way I can explain it. So you'll have written law in England and in the United States, which was essentially a pile of English colonies, but the judges say, we have the last word. So when we came to the formation of this country in the late 18th century, in the late 1700s, we set out this Constitution, Bill of Rights, all of that, the early Bill of Rights. And the presidents and the Congresses just started marching along, well, we've got written law, this is the law, this is the law. But there was in the Constitution a Supreme Court. And not too many years after the founding of the country, the Supreme Court put its foot down in one of its cases, Marbury v. Madison, the Supreme Court said, we take to ourselves judicial review. In other words, Congress, you pass laws, and they are the highest law. But if there is a challenge to the constitutionality of that law, we are the ones who will decide. And if we say that law is unconstitutional, then that law is unconstitutional. And it is gone. It is not there anymore. This was essentially common law re-emerging in the early United States. The tribal law, The judges would look back to the past and say, okay, this document, the Constitution, it does not have any meaning except in the context of the decisions we make with respect to it. That is what we call constitutional law. In other words, our country is not run by the Constitution. It is run by the constitutional law, the decisions about that Constitution. The Constitution just sits there. It is words on paper. And the idea you hear among conservatives of original intent, well, what does the Constitution say? That is Roman. And if you think about it, we are not Romans. We are Germanic in our base. We are other countries. We are certainly not at the behest of statutory law. The judges will decide what is and what is not constitutional. And they can, and in that way, for example, you look in the Constitution. The original Constitution, madam, you would not have been allowed to vote. I'm sorry, you're a woman. Sorry. So we damn well better be able to flex. You would have been 3/5 of a person in the original Constitution. Really? Even in 1850s, the Supreme Court was trying to do original intent. Well, it says we can't have this slavery thing's okay. We had the power to change. That document isn't our destiny. We are our destiny. We are common law at the end of the day. Again, Congress can pass any law it wants. It can pass a law that says you're ugly. And that is the law until the judges say, well, she's not, you know, she could use a little bit better choice in accessorization. But no, but you see, the judges have the final decision. So constitutional law is a growing, massive body of law. So when we want to have judges come to the bench, we don't want political hacks, dumbbells, and ideological freaks on the bench. We want people of deep, long knowledge. Respect for the past, but with one eye to what this means, our decisions mean to the future. That's how our law works. And as I've said in other classes, if you don't like that law, well, go the hell back to Rome. By the end, Lex Romana was so huge, so detached, that it didn't apply to anyone but the most powerful and the wealthiest. Does that sound familiar? By the time of the last sacking of Rome in the early autumn, late summer, early autumn of AD 476, when the German tribes led by the warlord Ardica came rolling into Rome to rock the city one last time, who was there to defend it? An emperor who was so pathetic they didn't even execute him? The generals who had already made their deals with the outlying tribes, the Aryan Christians of the German tribes, the merchants who had been screwed over and over and over again by the rich, the poor, who had nothing to lose with a new fist over them. It was just a version of the old one. The Visigoths, not knowing exactly what else to do, sort of just took Lex Romana and turned it into their own law. Lex Romana Visigoth, the law of the Romans for Visigoths. It was a mess. It was so friggin' complicated that when they tried to make something that was applicable out of Lex Romana Visigoth, it was like a mess. It was just like scholars, the kings of areas and the great academics, they just shook their heads. What the hell is this? And they sort of piled, mishmashed a bunch of stuff together, some stuff from the law books itself, some stuff from constitutions, some stuff that they'd heard about in a couple of cases. It was that bad that once the thread of it had been lost, no one could figure out what the hell anything meant in there, really. So that Lex Romana Visigoth was sort of like an interim law that applied to Roman citizens for about a century until it just was withered away and we came into the Dark Ages. But you see, common law is stronger than that. You burn the book, the law exists. And that's why I promote the idea, and I want you to understand this, that even in our age where our judges are bought and paid for, many of them are wholly inadequate for the positions that they're in, and our politicians pass insane laws, more and more of them, and our government does not even respond when we scream bloody murder. Are you nuts? You're spying on all of us, you freaks? None of that. All of that aside, underneath it is the whisper of the past. And if we cut that cord, we got nothing against the bad forces that are upon us now. Now let me take you off this bifurcation of law. And I'm going to take you to another division, a couple of other divisions of law. One that is relevant for business and for people is the difference between civil law and criminal law. Now, I know that my former professors, law people, are going to scream bloody murder. You're oversimplifying things to the point where you should be shot, professor, but this helps get you started. Civil law is the law between persons. That could be individuals. Remember, a person under the law doesn't necessarily mean a human being. Civil law is interpersonal law. Now, in civil law, you could have one person take legal action against another person. That could be you suing me. That could be the government suing me. That could be civil law. That could be a company suing another company for breach of contract. Contract is civil law. It could be many things. It is interpersonal. It has to do with an ancient belief in common law that we want to avoid blood for blood. It was early on that we understood, that tribes understood that when we have, okay, I've been wrong, I'm going to kill your ass. That's bad. That clan warfare, sure it's fun at first getting all ready for it and getting your suit of armor on and then saying, I'm going to kill a bunch of people. The bad part is, and I found this out in the service, they kill you back. You know, and that really sucks. You know these games where you come back to life? It doesn't work that way in real world. And you know the games where they cut you with a sword and the blood spatters in front of you and you say, oof, and then you go out and grab a sandwich in the refrigerator. In real life, you lie down on the ground and you scream for your mommy and you pee and you shit. So it was one of those things where great effort was put into finding a better, less destructive way to resolve disputes. In other words, let us make it part of our law that we will have a forum for grievances and that we will have a body of adjudicated law about grievances so that if, for example, I sneak into your hovel and you have a ham hanging from the ceiling that you were planning to keep for Christmas, and I steal it, and I get away, you catch me. You don't kill me. You sue me for the ham. I had already eaten it by the time you caught me. I ate it. So you don't kill me for the ham, you sue me, and you get your money back. Interestingly enough, in Old English, it was a term, hamsokken. You punch a person on his own property. That is hamsokken. And I accuse you, sir, of hamsokken. I was standing in my doorway. You walked up to me and said, "What hast thou done with my fair daughter?" And I say, "Nothing she did not like, fair sir." Upon which time, you turn into a raging monster and you punch me. Well, damn you. Now, I could go in and get my sword and run you through, but that means that she doesn't have, like, her dad at the wedding and all that, and that's kind of bad. Or I can prosecute you under civil law, person-to-person law, and I can make you give me money back, a reparation. That is a strong principle. Don't go after people yourself. Have the courts resolve things so that we don't have this blood-on-blood crap like we do in degenerate societies like Scotland, where the clans just go at it and beat each other up. Yes? Well, then you could, okay, we'll talk about the criminal aspect of it. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. There could also be criminal implications. So let me take you to criminal. Criminal law is the law that governs the state, the sovereign's interaction with humans, with people, with persons. Jeez. Criminal law is when is the sovereign. So you can sue me, prosecute, bring your grievance to a court under civil law against me, okay? Or I can against you, okay? But the sovereign could also come to deal with you as well. In that case, the sovereign is not really representing me at all. The sovereign is representing the people. When you go into a court, the people versus, that means that the sovereign is taking you on. Well, they might say, "Well, we're doing this on your behalf because you were hurt." Bullshit! Understand that the government doesn't give a rat's ass about your individual ass. All it cares about is the sovereign's interaction with the people. So, if the government can prosecute you civilly, you have committed a civil wrong against the people, or this person. But it can also prosecute you criminally. You can't prosecute me criminally. You can't. The state, using you as a witness, as its asset, can prosecute me for what I did to you criminally. But you can't do that. And when the state prosecutes me criminally for something that I did to you, that all you are is an asset. All you are is a witness. All you are is a means by which they can get a court to acknowledge that a criminal law was violated. In business law, civil action is taken by agencies, the EPA, the FTC, the SEC. Those regulatory agencies will go after you for civil matters. Civil means that there are fines and punitive damages and all of that involved. It's only if they go after, they cannot do it criminally. If there are criminal implications, or if the violations of law have risen to a sufficient level that criminality is involved, the regulatory agencies take the matter to the Department of Justice for prosecution as a criminal matter. So the regulatory agencies, generally speaking, if I make a mistake, they will fine me. There could be a civil action. But if I have violated a law in such a way that it is egregious and breaks a criminal law on the books, then they will take it to the Justice Department, state or federal level, the Attorney General of the state or something like that, and then they will prosecute me criminally. That means that businesses are under what might be called a double jeopardy, to the extent that the Supreme Court ruled a few decades ago that the government could prosecute you civilly and it could prosecute you criminally at the same time, in sequence. And so businesses still to this day scream bloody murder. That is double jeopardy. And the Supreme Court said, no, it's not. Yeah. Oh, there is a different standard of proof. You're right about that. But that does not mean that jeopardy, the argument is, against what the Supreme Court did, is this. We have already taken this matter to court, civilly. So if you take it, so that means jeopardy attached. It might have been just monetary jeopardy, but jeopardy attached. So when you go ahead and do it criminally, again, jeopardy is going to attach there by definition. That's double jeopardy. Sometimes the government will actually prosecute you civilly so that it will know your defense, so that when it prosecutes you criminally, you're already financially ruined and they already see your defense. Isn't that sweet? Sometimes they'll prosecute you criminally knowing they won't win, but it'll test how strong their case is against you civilly, because the threshold for civil is lower than the threshold. Threshold for criminal. Know this. There are different standards, as you mentioned, thresholds. Now, there's clear and compelling evidence. Clear and compelling evidence is not a threshold. It must meet that, but that is not insufficient. Just because the evidence is clear and compelling is not sufficient. That's hard, because most juries made up of common people just don't understand that even though the evidence is clear and compelling, that's not enough for a conviction. Then there is the preponderance of evidence. There's where you get into civil. If you can get to a preponderance of evidence, not only is it clear and compelling, but there's a preponderance of it, then you don't have to have all the jurors say, yeah. You have to have a majority of them say, yeah. And then there is a civil finding against you. But then the big one for criminal is, what is the one for criminal? Beyond reasonable doubt. And that is a high, high threshold. Understand that that is higher than clear and compelling evidence. That is higher than the preponderance of evidence. That is up there in the stratosphere. And unfortunately, in our country, we convict people we have more people in the prison system than any other country on earth. We have a higher rate of people in the prison system than any other country on earth. We beat the monstrous regimes of China, Iran. We do them one better. And part of that is because we have this sense in our country that you got to get tough on crime. So those, you know, that we don't really need to understand that reasonable doubt thing and all that. He's guilty, so I'm going to convict him. And that's how it works in this country. And it ain't going to change unless we get people a lot more educated than they are right now about law and about the how to keep a society from imploding on itself. Civil versus criminal. Now, there are other ways that you can break up law, too. And I'll bring up a couple of types of law right here to kind of emphasize. Tort law. Tort law. Madam, I am going to slap your face. That's a tort. It's a civil wrong against another. That one specifically is assault. It might be assault. You see, assault is putting another at concern of imminent danger. It doesn't mean that you're in fear of me. You showed me no fear. You should have shown fear. But the fact that you didn't show me fear does not mean it's not assault. You have to, the threshold is, she has to have a reasonable belief that she is in imminent danger of harm, personal harm. That's all assault is. It's a wrong against another. Now, I didn't slap you. I just pulled your hair and twirled you around a couple of times. That's battery, the unwanted touching of another. And notice the term touching. That has gotten really serious in recent years. Battery is just touching. Assault is putting the person at concern. But just touching is battery. Just touching is battery. So we might have a situation where we're just standing and talking, and then I sucker punch you. No assault, but there's battery. Because you had no fear or concern that anything was going to happen, but I did illegally touch you. Now I'm going to do something that... touch. I didn't want that, man. I don't know where your hands have been. That was an overture, wasn't it? You want me. I know you do. You've been looking at me. My rippling muscles. That's battery. Probably not assault because he didn't know what was going to happen. See, I got you. I caught you off guard. Okay, do you understand the concept of assault versus battery? They are different things. Very different things. But they are both civil wrongs against another. Now, if I were to touch you, notice I didn't touch you. I didn't touch you. But if I were to touch you, that's battery. But it probably would not rise to the level of criminal battery. If, however, I beat you until your face looked like Rocky Balboa's, then the state would step in and you could sue me for civil battery. The state could step in and represent the society against me in a criminal charge of battery. They wouldn't be representing you. They would be representing the society. They would use you as a witness to what happened. But the fact that I punched you in the face, there's a personal matter there, but there's also a society matter. The personal matter is a law. You could bring a grievance to a court against me. The society, however, saying that people should not punch each other, would prosecute me on behalf of the people, not on behalf of you. They don't care about you. I want you to understand that. You have your own forum, a civil court, and they're not going to let you hurt me, but they might tell me that I have to give you money back. No blood for blood, but reparations, absolutely. Interestingly, until a few centuries ago, more than a few centuries ago, in civil matters, let me give you a quick term. We use the word proof in the wrong way. Actually, it's not the wrong way because it's the way we think it's supposed to be used. We think proof means it has been established. No, it doesn't. The old meaning of proof is that it is a test. In the old ways, in a civil matter, if you were to accuse me of doing something to you in a civil way, no one else had seen it, but you said it happened, they would require that you prove it. And by proving it, that means that the first thing would be that they would test you for honesty. That might be something rather serious, like walking on hot coals or something like that. But before they would consider any matter that you claimed against me, they would want you to prove it. And that doesn't mean show perfect evidence. That means you're going to put yourself personally on the line to pursue your case. That comes down to us in our day and age as the concept that you are innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. In other words, we still carry to this day the assumption that an accusation has no weight unless the wronged, the person who said, "I am wronged," can prove it, test it. That's why you have to come to the witness stand to this day. You can't hide and say, "Oh, I was too traumatized by this." You have to test, you have to be tested. It's not going to happen unless you're tested. And unfortunately, there have been breakdowns in that. Understandable, but at the same time, those breakdowns have allowed for more and more ability to allow allow claimants to not really show whether or not they mean it. But remember that. Guilt is not established unless the test has been done. Tort law is wide. And interestingly enough, tort law applies to people, but it also applies to persons in general. A business can commit a tort against a person. A worker who gets hurt on the job, if there's no intention for that worker to have gotten hurt, but there's negligence, that's technically a tort. Now, we have a whole system called workers' compensation, which keeps courts from having to get involved in that. So some kinds of torts are so well established that we create mechanisms in business to deal with them. You're walking in Walmart. You're going to get a fine meal because you plan to have a nice dinner with your family, so you're getting the best, and that means going to Walmart. You're walking in there and you slip on a big water spill. You fall down, you break your ass. Okay? So you would sue Walmart for essentially in a tort claim, a wrong by a person against another person. But they would just simply settle it with the insurance would offer you a little money, and that would be the end of it. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. You have a car accident. That's a tort. Now, the state may come in and ticket one of the drivers, which has always amazed me. You've been in an accident, you're bleeding, half of your leg is hanging off, and they give you a ticket. You know, really? Can't you wait, you assholes? But no, that's the way it works. So there would be a tort. Now, you cream my car, you blasted, you maniac. Now, I could sue you. The insurance company would try to keep that from happening by offering me a settlement. Offering me a payout, but if I said, "No, I don't like that," I could still sue you. There's a tort, wrong of one against another. But then the state could also prosecute you for a wrong against the society. You ran a red light. That was a wrong against the society. They would ask me to testify, but they're not doing this on my behalf. They don't care about what happened to me. Now, I might care about the other side of it. If they can convict you before I sue you, I've got a stronger case in court. Go ahead.
So you don't have to press charges for them to pursue the person?
Interestingly enough, that's sort of a game. In many cases, the state will seek your assistance in pressing charges. That does not mean that you are creating the wellspring of the case. But what the state would be interested in is your willingness to be an asset in the prosecution. So if you say, "I don't want to press charges," that means that they would be much less likely on their own to win against the party that hurt. Yeah, go ahead. Wouldn't matter. Still not the primary victim. Probably not. Now, they would push you to get you to testify, to press charges. Because what they're looking for is really a direct witness statement that would then be entered, submitted to the court, and for the court to enter it into evidence as a fact of the case. Okay? But if someone else, but if you're not going to write that kind of a witness statement and show willingness to take it through to the end, they're not going to push it. They're just not going to push it. Good question, though. That's very good. It sort of reveals that what we think is going on, I'm pressing charges, and what is going on are two different matters. Sometimes you'll find that pressing charges, you want to press charges, the state's going to tell you, we're not going to do anything about this. You find that out. You know, I want you to look at something. I want you to look at my nose. Do you know if anything unusual? Is it a nice, perfect, straight, you know? That's right. It's pointing this way. Here's a rule. If you break your nose, don't try to fix it yourself. Second rule, if you break your nose, again, don't try to fix the first mess you made. See rule one. You see, you can get into a fight and, you know, there is clearly blood on the ground. There are a few teeth sticking out of your nose and things like that. But you could have the cops say, look, this looks to us like it was just an interpersonal matter. And, you know, unless you really want to prosecute, we're not going to worry about it. You're going to find that out. In other words, it's too trivial. They're not going to waste their time going to the witness stand and all that kind of stuff. They're not going to do it. They're just going to let it go. Unless you really, really want to push the matter. Now, if you've been shot, then obviously there are other issues involved. Or if you're half dead, there might be issues involved. But at the same time, know this. This happens to you, you're probably not going to get the cops to do anything about it. No, seriously. So I would recommend, given that you have a very straight nose and it complements those rugged yet boyish cougar bait features, yes, just stay out of fights, okay? Now, torts come in all flavors. I mean, there are so many different ways that you can have torts. There are torts of negligence. That means you just didn't pay attention when you were supposed to. You weren't trying to hurt anybody, but you hurt somebody. You can have things, some of the great torts over time. The man who was about to propose to his girlfriend in a restaurant, and a cow came through the roof and slammed in on the table. He was unable to propose to her. He sued under tort. Because, you know, it kind of ruined the mood, ruined the evening, and she saw it as a sign that cow come through ceiling. It seems a cow had fallen out of a plane. Cow comes through ceiling. That's a bad sign for this marriage. You can have all kinds of torts of different kinds. We'll get into that in contract law. But know this, that, for example, you hit me in a car accident. My wife can sue you for denial of consort, because essentially in tort law, if you create a condition where a person other than the first party is materially and measurably harmed, that person can sue you under tort. So in other words, if you hurt a guy and it makes it so that he can't have sex with his wife, she can sue you for denial of consort. You made it so that our marriage is imperfect. So keep that in mind when you have an accident. Where did this guy hit the steering wheel? Now, under contract, we'll get back into contract, some of this happens too. But that was tort. Other matters, just very briefly, business law is a broad subject, and I will tap on some of that in the next lecture. Know this, the business law is enormously complex. And if you are stepping into the world of business without at least a minimal grasp of business law, you are in so much trouble, because it doesn't matter whether you knew a law or not, it still applies to you. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. Now, when you're dealing with regulatory agencies, depending upon the era, A lot of regulatory agencies can be easy on you, especially in the first few years. Yeah, you screwed up. Okay, here's what you do, and they'll help you out. I found when I was a consultant for companies that were trying to go public, the Securities and Exchange Commission, they actually were, I was screwing up. I was an idiot. I thought, oh, I've got all these degrees and all this. I know business and I know finance. I knew jack. But these people at the SEC, when I was making mistakes, they weren't saying, well, we're going to tell you what to do here. They're not allowed to do that. But they would help me. They work a lot with businesses. But the one that we will do mostly in the next lecture is contract law. Contract law is civil law. It's not criminal law, unless you're talking about the social contract, a la Jean-Jacques Rousseau. But contract, in the sense that we know it, contract law is civil law. It is state law. It is not federal law. It is also common law. Yeah. Then you get into several matters. One is the contract should define where matters should be adjudicated. If that's not the case, then there are rules of the road. And interestingly enough, all of the states except one in the United States have a common agreement called the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code. I'll get into that next time. That is crucial for you to know at least some part of the UCC, because they essentially make all contracts compatible so that you don't have to write everything in a contract. A lot of it is already, the states have all signed on to this treaty between the states that's really not the federal government. It's just all of us agree, all the states agree, contracts in all these states will work these ways. It doesn't cover everything, but boy, it helps. So that's all I have for you today. I thank you.